This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
My name is Pam Corcoran Parker. I'm a professor of English here, and it's my pleasure tonight to introduce our reader, Andrea Palpant-Dilley. But on behalf of Whitworth University, it's my great pleasure to welcome you. And I'd also like to introduce to you tonight a promising young writer and film producer, Andrea Palpant-Dilley, and a dear friend as well. I'd especially like to welcome those of you who are coming from the Spokane community, friends and family of Andrea, and to welcome especially Andrea's family, Sam and Judy Palpant, and her brothers Finn and Nate, their wives Kristen and Darian, and her nieces and nephews. Wait, there's a lot of them. Kylie, Hannah, Noah, Samantha, Elias, Ellie, and Clara. Couldn't read my own handwriting. But we especially are happy that you're here to support your aunt. So, we also wanted to mention that Andrea flew into Spokane last night with her newest member of her family, Eden, who has been with her today off and on with the able help of her grandma. And I'd like to thank, in absentia, Andrea's husband, Stephen Dilley, a philosophy professor at St. Edward's, who is at home in Austin, Texas, with their youngest, or their oldest daughter, Madeline, who's about 2 years now, right? Three. Oh, dear. That happened fast. Andrea's roots in Spokane run deep. I, for those of you who aren't familiar with her as well, I'd like to go ahead and mention some of the things that are worth mentioning about her. As most of you know, she was a former student and 2000 graduate of Whitworth University's Departments of English and Spanish. She was also nominated as a 2009 Whitworth Alumna of the Year. She's an accomplished author, blogger, and documentary filmmaker. And she's also, I think, venturing off into lots of other kinds of media as ways of publishing. And it's really exciting to see her career arc because it really shows us the different ways that people with creative language skills are moving into the world. She has, her work, as I said, has appeared in a variety of mediums, including documentary film. She has seven or more, with subjects ranging from Japanese-American internment, the ongoing crisis in Sudan, Hoop Fest, young adults' search for vocation, and even a celebration of Leonard Oakland at the time of his retirement a few years back. Her periodicals, her articles appear in periodicals in places such as our local Spokane Inlander weekly magazine, and then also in national magazines such as G's, The Utney Reader, and Rock and Sling, which is a literary magazine that's housed here at Whitworth University, but it's national in scope. She has written online at the Huffington Post, CNN's My Faith blog, and Duke Divinity's online magazine, Faith and Leadership. She has a number of works out in collections, essay collections such as Jesus Girls, True Tales of Growing Up Female and Evangelical, and one forthcoming in a collection called I Speak for Myself, American Women Being Christians, coming next year. Tonight, Andrea is here to read from her first book, Faith and Other Flat Tires, Searching for God on the Rough Road of Doubt, which tells of her faith journey from her childhood in Kenya as a daughter of Quaker missionaries through a turbulent period in her young adulthood that led to her exit from the church. Her book is part of part coming-of-age story and part spiritual memoir. In her introduction, she tells us that, quote, her pilgrimage was motivated by three concurrent desires for faith, love, and meaning. She was trying to find purpose for her work, a partner for her journey, and a worldview she could believe in. Andrea's search is both deeply personal and broadly universal. Her search is also deeply human and Christian. Her work really falls into the category of spiritual memoir or autobiography and joins a long tradition that starts in the 4th century with Augustine and his Confessions, and then continues in the hands of the Protestant evangelicals such as Puritans like John Bunyan, whose work Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners was published in the 17th century, as well as his fictionalized version of that, Pilgrim's Progress, which Andrea takes as a kind of framework for her own memoir. This form was powerfully transformed in the 19th century in America, particularly by former slaves such as Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs, and then into the 20th century as literature of witness with powerful works such as Elie Wiesel's Night and also Edwige Chantecaut's Emigre narrative, Brother, I'm Dying. So it really falls into this longer literary trajectory. More recently, we've been enjoying memoirs that are at the intersections of gender and faith from authors such as Rhoda Jansen, whose work you might know, Mennonite in A Little Black Dress in 2009, Anne Lamott's works such as Traveling Mercies, Laura Winner's book Girl Meets God, and Kathy Norris, who was the author of Dakota. As Hannah Noh Tess stated in her introduction to Jesus Girls, testimony and spiritual autobiography have been historically significant ways for women to speak up in evangelical circles. Sermons have historically been a privileged masculine discourse, so these kinds of narratives of personal experience with faith have been an arena in which women have been able to speak to their faith to a broader community. Tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce her and to also just recount the week that I've spent with her book with my English 126 women writers students. We've been struck by the authenticity of her struggle and the beauty of her language and the wisdom of her search. At times the book is achingly honest, and other times it's side-splittingly funny. I look forward to sharing her work with you tonight and to welcoming Andrea home to Whitworth once again. Please join me in welcoming Andrea.
Thanks, Pam, for that introduction. I had a dream about 2 weeks ago that I was standing right here, just as I am now, except that I had a towel wrapped around my head. I'm not making this up. And I was frantically trying to find my place. Apparently, I had lost pages and such. And I woke up and I thought, in college, I used to have dreams about being that tired, haggard college student who showed up unprepared to an exam. Now I have dreams about being a tired, haggard mother who shows up unprepared to readings. So, anyway, thankfully it was just a dream. But as Pam said, I flew in last night with my daughter Eden, so if you hear screaming of the infant quality, you'll know why. She's down the hallway. But it's great to be here. Thank you so much for coming. I'm reading, as Pam said, from Faith and Other Flat Tires. I'm going to be reading two different sections. The first one will be pulled from the first part of the narrative, the prior to leaving the church part of the story. And the second will come from, the second will come from returning to church portion of the narrative. They're composites. I've kind of tried to pull pieces that will give you a sense of what the story is all about, for those of you who haven't read it. A little bit of context. There are various references, obviously, that won't make sense out of context, but one that I'll try to describe before getting into the reading. In the chapter prior to that, which I'll be reading tonight, I tell the story of my baptism as a child, and some of you were actually there. I was 12. I was baptized in the Little Spokane River by my youth pastor. And I still remember standing in that current. He was a tall man, had his hand in the back, the small of my back, dipping me into the water, bringing me back up. It was a very poignant memory for me, and I tell that as kind of the culmination of this last chapter that segues into this next one. But keep that image in mind. It will come back at the end of this chapter that I'm reading tonight. So this comes from Why Isn't God Like Eric Clapton? Chapter 5. And some of my family members who are here are featured, so you can ask them about the veracity of the narrative afterwards. See, is this really true? Okay, so why isn't God like Eric Clapton? One winter afternoon when I was 12 years old, my father picked up a hitchhiker. My two brothers were sitting with me in the back seat of our Plymouth Voyager van, which my grandfather had hauled off the junkyard and rebuilt. The cars we drove were all orphans that had been rolled or flooded or wrecked. The Voyager had a big dent in the sliding door from a downhill tumble. The hitchhiker looked 16 or 17, a tall Scandinavian wearing blue jeans with big holes in the knees. It was 35 degrees out. He ducked his head and climbed into the van with us, and then my dad drove on. The ensuing conversation, which I will never forget, went something like this. "These are my kids, Andrea, Ben, and Nate. My name's Sam. What's your name?" "Donovan," the hitchhiker said. "Oh, that's a good name," my father said. "Have you ever heard of Amy Carmichael?" No. "She was a Christian missionary to India," my dad said, "who worked to save young girls from sex trade enslavement." I'm not making this up. My brothers are here to attest. "The place where she worked was called Donover, which is kind of close to your name, Donovan. So you have a good name, a name with Christian purpose." Hitchhiker said, "Oh." In the hitchhiker's long pause that followed, I remember thinking, my father is out of his mind. Preying on this young hitchhiker who wanted a ride and instead got a church sermon on Christian missionary history. I felt embarrassed in the same way I did when my dad prayed over our food in a restaurant and the waiter brought the ketchup while he was still praying. Donovan rode with us for several miles until we reached the cutoff road to our house. After pulling the van onto the shoulder to let him out, my dad turned to my older brother, who was about the same size as the hitchhiker, and said, "Ben, why don't you give Donovan your jeans? It's cold out." In the back seat of the van, Ben took off his pants and gave them to the hitchhiker, while my little brother and I looked sideways at each other. Proverbial Christian wisdom says you give away the coat off your back, not the pants off your backside. In exchange for my brother's jeans, the hitchhiker handed over his own, the jeans with big holes in the knees, and my brother wrestled them on. Then Donovan got out. He was headed farther north toward Canada. I watched from the back seat as he diminished into the distance, a tall, lean figure standing on the side of a long winter road. These years later, I remember the whole exchange as a small act of goodness. My father, the funny priest, blessed a hitchhiker not with holy water, but with jeans. He said a benediction of sorts over Donovan and then sent him off on pilgrimage. Although I didn't know it at the time, that experience foreshadowed the day I would get up and leave behind the Christian traditions of my childhood, the missionary narratives, the public restaurant prayers, the doctrines and tenets of faith, all of it. I would become the one climbing out of the car and striking out on pilgrimage on my own. The reasons for my discontent were complicated. By most standards, I had a healthy childhood. I grew up as the daughter of Quaker missionaries in a rural Kenyan community that laid the foundation for my faith. I spent the rest of my childhood in the Northwest, being raised in a stable Presbyterian church that gave me hymns and mission trips and potluck dinners. I was surrounded by smart, conscientious Christians, the kind of people who discussed humanism in Sunday school, read 19th century Russian novels in their free time, and took meatloaf to firefighters when Eastern Washington went up in flames one fall. They taught me Sunday school, came to my birthday parties, and stood at my baptism in Christian love. But love is never enough. When you tip over the steep edge of childhood and plummet into puberty, you grow big feet. Everything about you becomes awkward, including your heart. In seventh grade, my English teacher required us to bring in our own book for free reading time. I chose a paperback from my parents' bookshelf. The title appeared in bold embossed letters on the cover, "Disappointment with God" by Philip Yancey. It's terrible. I remember my teacher leaning over my desk with her eyebrow raised at the book I'd brought to school with me. "What's that about?" she asked. I don't remember what I said. Probably something about the Israelites living in exile in the wilderness. Again, To her, the book no doubt seemed like an odd, precocious choice for a junior high student. That kind of literature was read by faith-weary 40-somethings, not 13-year-olds. But to me, Disappointment with God seemed like a perfectly natural book to pick up. As a teenager undergoing what psychologists might call spiritual individuation, I wanted to figure out what I believed. And how else do you talk about faith but in terms of doubt and disappointment? My Sunday school teachers can tell you what happened to me at that age. I started asking questions. Questions I knew they couldn't easily answer. Questions that people had been wrestling with in much more sophisticated forms for centuries. Every Sunday, I went to class in a third-floor room lined with ratty couches like those you might find in the basement of a college dorm. Sunk back into a couch cushion, I would raise my skinny arm to demand all sorts of impossible answers to impossible questions. I wanted to know, why doesn't God talk the way he talked to Moses from burning bushes? Why is there so much war in the Old Testament? Why is there a homeless man standing on the corner in the cold? Why do little boys die of tuberculosis? The questions didn't come out of nowhere. They came from growing up in Kenya. They came, too, from my experiences on mission trips, serving cooking lard and corn to refugees, helping to build a one-room house for a homeless family. After a while, I started wondering, what's going on here? Who's running the show? Every time I saw suffering of any kind, I felt a stone drop into my heart. Lo Sikoi was a stone. It's a story from a previous chapter. Homeless, hungry people were a stone. Refugees were a stone. Collectively, they became the burden I hauled around in my growing disappointment with God. Not unlike most teenagers undergoing their first spiritual or emotional crisis, I found solace and escape in music. In particular, the shift in my musical interests reflected the shift going on in my heart. I went from church hymns like How Great Thou Art to the songs of drug-addled '80s bands. The transition happened over a period of years. When I was in junior high and he was in high school, Ben, that's my older brother, started tracking all the current music in the contemporary Christian scene. I followed Ben's tastes. We listened to Michael W. Smith and Amy Grant. We listened to Carmen, the Italian stallion who greased his hair back and looked like a mafia hitman turned pastor. We listened to Code of Ethics, an electronica group whose music sounded like that of any early 90s band, but with a higher power theme kind of tacked on. We bought tickets, too, for Christian rock concerts and stood in the metal bleachers of the high school gym, getting our adrenaline digs to Christian songs like Addicted to Jesus, Hand of Providence, and Radically Saved. Everything changed a few years later. Ben went off to college at a Quaker liberal arts school in Oregon, moved into a dorm room with someone who liked to listen to Britpop and other mainstream music. Shortly after, Ben started sending me cassette tapes. "It's from your brother," my mother said one night while cutting an onion for dinner. She pointed to a padded manila envelope on the counter. I opened the package and found a tape along with a short note written on a torn piece of notebook paper. "My roommate Hans," Ben wrote, "has all this great music. I hope you like it." Scanning the tape's cover insert, I saw the names of song titles and musicians I didn't recognize. Depeche Mode, U2, Erasure. The tape was labeled The Secular Collection. That is a Christian kid for you. As a child growing up with an evangelical vocabulary, I had the impression that secular was a bad word. Its synonym, worldly, was another bad word. Our church didn't follow a strict separation from American pop culture. As a kid, though, I tended to see the world in more black and white terms than did the adults around me. To me, the difference between Christian and secular cultures seemed as obvious as the difference between a healthy meal and a shelf-baked Twinkie. One tasted better but rotted out your insides. The other one had vitamin longevity. That Christian-secular divide ran straight through the territory of music. When he left for college, Ben crossed that divide and carried me with him. After opening the package at the kitchen counter that evening, I took a drive in the Plymouth hatchback that still belonged to Ben and had the ICFU stuck on the back bumper. I had just gotten my driver's license. With no particular destination in mind, I climbed into the car, buckled my seatbelt, and slip-popped the secular collection into the car's temperamental tape player. One of the first tracks I heard, Higher Love by Depeche Mode, seemed like a song a person might listen to while running alone at night. The melody was minor key, gloomy, and beautiful. The lyrics, though, sounded vague and slightly affected. I can taste more than feel. This burning inside is so real. Moved, lifted higher, moved by a higher love. Who knows what the lead singer Dave Gahan was trying to say? Maybe the song was a post-Christian plea for God by a British musician who was once declared clinically dead from drug overdose. Maybe it was just a cry for higher purpose. For me, listening to his minor key dirge made me want to brood and smoke on the back porch in that cliche coming-of-age kind of way. It also afflicted me with genuine discontent. After the secular collection, Ben sent me other tapes. He labeled each one with his meticulous handwriting, listing the artists and song titles and album names. Every evening, I set up a cheap tape player on my bedroom desk and listened to those cassettes. I was the diligent high school student doing her homework to music from the other side. To anyone who didn't grow up in a semi-protected religious environment, all of this will seem almost comical or melodramatic. I started listening to non-Christian music. Big deal. But that's the point. To me, it was a big deal. Now, as an adult, I see that tension between sacred art and secular art as a mostly false dichotomy. Back then, that dichotomy seemed very real. It meant something to me. On one side, I saw church, hymns, and my parents. On the other side, I saw angst, doubt, and Depeche Mode. People who know my story sometimes ask me what I would have changed about my upbringing. They want to know what would have kept me inside the church when I wanted to step outside. Subtext, what might they do to keep their kids inside the faith? I tell them, nothing. I had everything. I grew up in a good church and in a good family. I had smart, well-educated Christians around me. They allowed me to push back. They let me doubt and question. They let me listen to so-called secular music. But I wanted more space. In the same way that teenagers feel the urge to sneak out at 2 a.m. and go smoke pot with their friends, I felt a growing urge to transgress boundaries in the realm of faith. These subtle transgressions took place both in public and in private. They happened inside my head, in Sunday school, at youth group, and most often in discussion with my father. For all his evangelical zeal, my dad had gone through his own skeptic phase in college and consequently understood mine. He took the brunt of my struggle. I started fighting with him, not over the usual curfews and chores, although we had those fights too, but over theology and metaphysics and church. Our debates seemed robust and important, the kind of fighting every kid should have if she needs it. My dad and I would sit for hours sometimes and hash things out. One particular conversation with him became a harbinger of the doubt to come. It marked a turning point in my pilgrimage. It cleared the path for my pending exit from church. I was 17. My high school graduation was only a few months away. After going out for breakfast with my dad one Saturday morning, we drove to a hi-fi store to buy desktop computer speakers I needed for college. My dad went down one aisle, and I went down another, till I came across a TV playing Eric Clapton, Unplugged, in concert. I don't remember which song Clapton was playing as I stood watching, maybe Running on Faith or Malted Milk. What caught my attention was not the song itself, but its effect on the audience. I watched the people swaying, clapping, singing. They had the unmistakable demeanor of a congregation in worship. I know what that attitude of worship means. I listen to music as prophecy, as memory, as longing. It feeds the hunger inside, but also extends it. Most music is never good enough, hard enough, or heavy enough to fully satisfy. But when it does satisfy, you feel it deep in your gut. And if visceral impact is the mark of greatness, then Clapton was better than God. He was a man you could listen to and touch, a man wearing shoes and singing songs about grief and love and the San Francisco Bay. Although it might seem strange to have a crisis of faith while surrounded by TV screens, that's exactly what happened. I discovered what philosophers call the problem of God's hiddenness. How am I supposed to relate to a God I can't see or touch or hear? Why isn't God present the way Clapton is present? Why doesn't he have a grunge band and give concerts at the Key Arena so that anybody who wants to could come and buy a ticket? Halfway through the second set, God would climb down into the mosh pit to dance with us, and the crowd would erupt with whooping at this revelation of divine booty-shaking proximity. And then, while drinking a Corona at a post-concert bash with Pearl Jam, God would get up from his patio chair to say, "Can I take a turn on your Fender, Eddie? I haven't played in years." And that would be the moment we'd all been waiting for. God would play a deep, striking riff on the electric guitar. "Dad, look at them," I said as my father walked up behind me in the store aisle. "Look at all those people." "What about them?" he said. "Look at how they're listening," I said. "It's almost religious. All I see are people looking for a God they can't find." My father nodded. "How are we supposed to live with such ambiguity?" I said. "Well," my dad said, rocking back on his heels the way he always did while deep in thought, "you seek grace and truth and live as best you can in the conviction of what you know. It's all you can do." "How did you decide to believe?" I said. "I wrestled with this stuff for a long time," he said. "And then I knew I had to make a decision. I had to go one direction or another." I turned back to the television screen. Staring at the Clapton concert just then, I felt the antithesis of what I'd experienced at my baptism years earlier. God was not a pastor standing in a river, holding me against the oncoming current. God was not a singer making sense of my longing. He was somewhere out there in the cosmos, other and untouchable, or maybe even non-existent. And I was left adrift, wanting the blessing of a priest, but with no one to bless me, except a man singing the blues. So that's the first excerpt. That gives you some sense of the era in which I was leading up to my departure from the church. There's obviously a lot more to the story. The sacred-secular dichotomy was only one of many dimensions to my struggle with faith. I struggled with the problem of evil. I won't read passages that pertain to that tonight. I'm going to skip over all of that. I'm going to read a portion from the latter part of the book. It comes from a chapter called Taking My Demons to Church. Before I do that, I want to read a quote that's included in the book that my mother actually sent to me when I was in college. It's from Flannery O'Connor. Back in 1962, she was corresponding with a young man named Alfred Korn. And he wrote to her, apparently, and basically disclosed to her that he was struggling with his faith and wanted to correspond. So they went back and forth. And this excerpt comes from a letter that she wrote to him. "I think that this experience you're having of losing your faith, or as you think of having lost it," she wrote, "is an experience that in the long run belongs to faith. I don't know how the kind of faith required of a Christian living in the 20th century can be at all if it is not grounded on this experience that you're having right now of unbelief. This may be the case always, not just in the 20th century. Peter said," that's a misattribution, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." It is the most natural and most human and most agonizing prayer in the Gospels. And I think it is the foundation prayer of faith. For those of you who've been raised in a religious environment, you're, I'm sure, very familiar with this faith-doubt dichotomy she talks about in that passage. And part of what was really illuminating for me when I read that passage and part of what motivated my return to the church in part was this idea that doubt is not in opposition to faith. It's something that can actually be a healthy, soul-searching, life-giving part of faith. And that was a moving idea for me. this idea that I could ask my questions inside the space of the church, inside the sacred space of the sanctuary. And that idea drives a lot of this book, and it drives, as I said, in part, my return to the church. It's much more complex than that, but I wanted to just touch on that before I move into this next passage. And you'll see that reflected a little bit in this. So this comes from Taking My Demons to Church. And again, this is a bit of a composite. I'm skipping over a lot of territory here in terms of what transpires in the story after I leave the church. So Taking My Demons to Church. The year after I graduated from college, I left the church. One Sunday morning while listening to a sermon, I stood up right in the middle of the service, leaned over to my father, and said, "This is bullshit." Then I made my way to the end of the pew and marched out of the sanctuary. The sermon didn't sit right with me. More than that, I was tired of church. I was tired, too, of all the intellectual questions that plagued me. The problem of imperfect community. Why does the church seem so screwed up? The problem of divine hiddenness. Why does God seem distant and inaccessible? And most of all, the problem of evil. Why does a good God allow suffering? Why do babies suffer from AIDS? How is that even possible? Walking out of church in that moment, I said in so many words, "To hell with it, I'm done." I wandered for years in that state of churchlessness. And then one morning at age 25, I woke up, climbed into my car, and drove downtown to attend a 10 a.m. church service. I won't give away the whole story of how or why I came back to the church. What matters for now is that I went back. If I follow the standard testimonial conversion narrative for Christians, the script for my life story might go something like this. Step 1, grow up in a Christian church. Step 2, go off to college away from said church. Step 3, be exposed to the enticements of secular life. Step 4, try drugs and cigarettes and Pearl Jam. Step 5, leave the church because of so-called worldly enticements. Step 6, experience epiphany. Realize vapidness of said secular things. Step 7, return to church with penitent heart. And step 8, reestablish faith, discover good living. That's not really my story. I left the church because of my own internal discontent with faith and life. And when I came back to church, I still carried that same discontent. I walked into church feeling confused, still agitated by my questions and doubts. To be honest, I wasn't really sure I wanted to be there. I sat in the back row. I didn't feel like praying. I didn't feel like singing. And yet I sat there, Sunday after Sunday, listening to the pastor and the organ pipes, and trying to figure out what was going on in my dark, conflicted heart. I said to a friend at the time, "I think I'm working out my demons." "You always have demons," he said. "Yes, I'll always have demons," I said. "But I might as well take my demons to church." For me, going back to church was like going back to see an old friend that I'd been estranged from for years. I felt nervous and anxious. I felt nostalgic, too, walking into the sanctuary and seeing the pews where I'd sat for 15 years of my life, the pulpit where the pastors had preached, and the stage where youth interns had performed their campy VBS skits every summer. Wondering if I'd come back too soon, I thought, am I ready to be back at church? On one Sunday morning in particular, I remember standing at the back of the sanctuary, in the same place the bride stands before she walks down the aisle and commits her life to someone. I saw my parents in the same place they'd sat for the last 20 years of their church attendance. After holding back for a moment, I passed the back row, walked forward toward the front of the church, and sat down with my parents as if it was a perfectly normal thing to do. "Please rise for the doxology," the pastor said. He held his robe-draped arms out toward the congregation to bring us to our feet for the singing of the doxology. The whole service was still familiar to me, the liturgy, the prayers, the sacrament of communion. Even my parents' habits were the same. My mother penciled notes in her bulletin. My father nodded at notable insights in the sermon. I sat next to them for the duration of the service, taking it all in. At the end of the service, the pastor held out his arms again and said, "Please rise and join hands for the final hymn." By tradition on Communion Sunday, the congregation held hands in a long, unbroken chain and sang the hymn, "Bind Us Together." My parents stood up first. After a brief hesitation, I stood up too and began singing along. I held my mother's hand on one side and the hand of a stranger on the other. "Bind us together, Lord, bind us together with cords that cannot be broken." A skeptical philosopher like Nietzsche, had he been sitting beside me that day, might have told me I was caving in to group pressure. "The herd," he would scratch in pencil on the side of the bulletin before passing it back to me in the middle of the sermon. Leaning forward from the pew behind, Karl Marx might have whispered in my ear that I was succumbing to religion as the opiate of the masses, avoiding the admission that my belief was just a bourgeoisie myth used to control the populace. God was like a drug, a temporary fix, an escape from reality. At coffee hour after church, while sipping lukewarm coffee, Freud might have sauntered up to tell me that, given my unresolved sexual frustrations, not to mention issues with my father, it was no wonder I had taken up religion again. The church and I were polar magnets. Eventually, after straining for so long to pull away, I would snap back into place. But then, if Nietzsche, Marx, and Freud had said those things to me, I would have cornered them all at coffee hour. Even in my ambivalence about church, I would tell them I could sense in my heart a strong longing for God. Frederick Buechner said, "Faith is homesickness." That was how it felt to me. If we were accidents of a godless universe, I would ask, then why did I sense this enduring pull toward God, the Alpha, the Omega, the unmoved mover? Why did pain and suffering seem so cosmically significant? Didn't it all mean something? I knew from my Western Civ course in college that Plato believed in the forms, unchanging, eternal ideas written into the human being. "We lose these ideas in the trauma of birth," he said, "and spend the rest of our lives trying to recover what we lost." God, too, seemed like something lost that I was trying to find again. To me, longing for God was like hearing music from an open window on the street, or seeing mountains off in the distance. The yearning felt almost like a grief, a cry born into my heart before the human heart ever existed, a desire so deep and far back that it seemed almost prehistoric. I sensed the Imago Dei, the image of God within me. I was Plato's child searching for the lost language of my origins. I was a homing bird traveling with my outspread wings, carried by an innate compass, and crossing 1,000 miles to get back to the place where I began. Even disbelief, I would tell them, was part of my search for God. Doubt impelled faith over a lifetime. Doubt was born from disappointment. Disappointment was born of longing, and longing was born of the Imago Dei. C.S. Lewis, in his preface to Pilgrim's Regress, says, "The human soul was made to enjoy some object that is never fully given, nay, cannot be imagined as given, in our present mode of subjective and spatio-temporal experience." If that was true, then this too was true. While I stood singing a hymn in an old Presbyterian church, feeling the start of a deep, uneasy peace, my doubt was my desire to touch the untouchable, to possess the presence of God. Here ends the reading.
How long do you want to do questions? About 10 minutes, maybe, or until 8?
Yes, he said until 8. So I'll say, okay.
Thanks so much, Andrea. Andrea will take questions for a few minutes, and also wanted to let you know that after she finishes with the questions, we will have an opportunity for you to purchase books as well as to get a signature on any of the books you may already have. So first of all, let's start with those questions that you may have. You have to show your hands, and you'll have to speak up because we don't seem to have more than one mic. Oh, we now have two. Cool.
Can you just speak a little bit about the process of writing this book? Where were the struggles? Where were the joys? And maybe a little bit about the publishing process, too, that you went through.
Sure. Well, I was an English major.
Chuckle.
That means that I had, for my own, I will only speak for myself, but I had a very idealized conception of what publishing looked like. Sort of picture yourself being hoisted on the shoulders of your community and carried into the public square, but it doesn't look anything like that. It's more like staggering through the public square, feeling lonely and vulnerable, despising yourself a little bit for exposing yourself in such a transparent way. That's the truth. It's an act of art, it's an act of ministry, but it's not an act of triumph. So the publishing process, at least with this, you know, this particular genre, spiritual memoir, any kind of non-fictional, personal non-fiction is obviously involves a lot of personal disclosure. So that was the hardest part, Gretchen, yeah, to answer your question, I think, was just kind of reckoning with what stories do I tell. I worked for a number of years in the film industry, and one of the things we talk about is disclosing and then withholding. You have to disclose enough to compel your audience, but you also have to withhold. You have to restrain enough to keep them moving through the narrative. And you also have to restrain enough, I would add, to maintain your own dignity as an author and to protect the dignity of those you're writing about. So that was also something that was really challenging in terms of writing about my own narrative, which obviously intersects with my family, intersects with past friendships, present friendships. Trying to do that in a way that was dignifying and respectful was tough. And also trying to disclose enough to compel my reader, but again, to withhold and to restrain enough to protect my own sense of privacy, of which there's little left. So that's a great question, Gretchen. Yeah. Other questions? Come on, I just disclosed my whole story. It's your turn now. Yeah, Barb.
The need for forgiveness and mm-hmm. the need for the blood of Christ to cleanse us from that. So in terms of your own struggle with faith, did a sense of not reckoning or being clear about your own sinfulness, did that ever enter into it? Do you understand what my question is?
I do. Ask it another way. I just want to enter into it a little bit more here.
Growing up in a Christian home, being a good girl, did you have any questions about the need for the death of Christ to cleanse you from your sins? Did that ever enter into your doubts?
That's a great question. It's a really big question. You know, Barb, most of my struggle and most of what I depict in the story, honestly, had more to do with theism than it had to do with the Christian faith. That was my starting point. So I'm going to answer that question a little bit in a circumspect way here. I was struggling so fundamentally that I had to step all the way back and kind of exit from not just the Christian, the tenets of Christian faith, but theism itself. I don't think I went so far as to consider myself an atheist. I would say I moved back to a position of agnosticism of some kind. But I think I was struggling not so much with issues around salvation. I think those were what I would consider stage two of my struggle with Christianity. My initial struggle, my most foundational struggle, which I depict in the book, had to do with theism, and obviously Christian theism in particular, but I was really struggling mostly with foundational questions, philosophical questions about, does God exist? And if God does exist, do I believe in a benevolent God? How do I feel about that that whole can of worms. So that's my answer to that question. It's much more complex than that. But I would say those questions around salvation and particular aspects of the gospel message were secondary to my journey. But it's a great question. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Sarah. Yes, I will. So the question has to do with how does my experience of having gone through a faith crisis affect how I'm going to parent? Ooh, that requires a beer, a bar, and about 3 hours. I now profoundly appreciate what my parents went through, honestly. And I had some idea at the time, I think. I remember looking at my mother and thinking, this is really painful. And now I understand why. You know, my parents spent literally 18 years of my life raising me in the Christian tradition, and then I went off to college and started throwing it out. So, I think I married a philosopher, first of all. Let's get a little context here. So, I'm grateful for that in the sense that I think my husband will play a similar role for my kids if they go through a crisis, and they may not. But if they do, I feel thankful that they have a dad who has philosophical training, understands some of the really difficult, profound questions of the human experience, can listen to those, respect them, and struggle with my kids. And I think because I've gone through that experience myself, I hope that I'll be sympathetic if they go through that. But I can see now as a parent why it would be profoundly difficult to watch your kid go through a faith crisis not knowing if they're going to come back. And that's, you know, and you respect your kids for whatever decision they make. You know, if my children decide to depart from the faith, they will still be my children. I will still love and adore them, and I will walk with them in whatever journey they go through, knowing what that was like for me and knowing how significant it was that my community and my family walked with me, gave me margin to ask those questions, and didn't ostracize me for struggling with faith. And that was a gift. And many of you are here, so I thank you for that. So, yeah, other questions? Suzanne.
Andrea, I know you mentioned some of the things in the book that will answer this, but since you're sharing it tonight with everybody, can you name any of the things that were going on at age 25? Upon your return to church, what were the other factors that might have been making you ready then?
Boy, that's a great question, Suzanne. I would say a couple of things. Part of it was philosophical. In the book, one of the main questions that I ask has to do with the problem of evil. Why would a good God allow suffering? And reckoning with that question meant that I had to entertain alternative worldviews. You know, and as I started pondering and thinking about, well, what does this mean if I don't want to be a theist? What does it mean to be a naturalist? That's the term my husband would use for someone who doesn't believe in God. If I want to be a naturalist, what does that really look like? And part of what I had to reckon with is that justice, the notion of justice, it's difficult to anchor that in a naturalist worldview, in the sense that I'm holding an AIDS baby in an orphanage in Kenya, and I tell this story. If I want to be a naturalist, I can't hold that baby and say this is unjust. It's just biology. It's just survival of the fittest. And that didn't sit right with me at a really deep, profound level. And I think that was a turning point for me in realizing, well, I think I need to be a theist. Justice matters to me. And obviously, what I'm articulating here is a very, very brief overview of a much more complex philosophical issue, so pardon that. But that was part of what compelled me, I think, was realizing that I did believe. I wasn't sure what I thought about God, but I realized philosophically I have to believe in God if I'm going to make claims about justice and injustice. I have to be anchored in some notion of objective morality. So part of it was philosophical, Suzette. Part of it, as I said before, when I read that Flannery O'Connor quote, was realizing that my questions belonged inside the sanctuary. These questions about justice and injustice, these questions about suffering, are more difficult to ask in a naturalistic worldview. And I had to come to the conclusion that they belong inside the Christian faith for me. And I felt compelled to carry them back into the sanctuary, hence the title, you know, Taking My Demons to Church. I don't have this all worked out. I don't have all the answers. But I felt a compulsion to take those questions and those doubts, bring them into the sanctuary, and be in community with the kinds of people who struggled with those questions too and were living with them in much more profound ways than I was. So that's a short answer, Suzette. There was a lot more than that, but those are certainly some of the catalysts that took me back to church. Yeah, go ahead, Bert. Oh, actually, it will be banned reading in my house. My children are not allowed to touch this book until they're 35, maybe. They're not allowed to date until they're 35, so maybe that's a good, they can do both at the same time. Okay, other questions? Yeah, we're here.
First off, I want to thank you for joining our class today. It was great. I've gone along in some of my pilgrimage as well, although my father was a master chief in the Navy, so questioning was kind of out of bounds, especially after he caught me with my first Motley Crue CD. Yeah, so I got in a little bit of trouble for that. He wanted to exercise tough love on me. My question had to do with what you did finally start asking these questions in the sanctuary, obviously as a mature woman and a mature person, were you able to discard some of those stones that were in your heart or just whittle some of those down? Were you able to really start to get some answers to those questions or at least get some peace in knowing that God is a little bit more accessible? Or where are you at with that now?
Again, a beer, a bar, in 3 hours. That's a great question. I would say yes and no to that. I would say yes, in the sense that having come back to the church, I feel a deep sense of peace, not because I have somehow attained all the answers. I think to say so would be dishonest for me, and disingenuous. But I feel a sense of peace in the sense that I believe God honors our honesty. When we think about doubt, we think of it sometimes as being an act of resistance. But I think all you have to do is look at Scripture, Job, Lamentations, the Psalms, to realize that doubt is really an intrinsic part of the faith experience. And I think when I came back to the church, I did experience a sense of peace. Again, not because I had the answers, but because I felt like I had come to a sacred space within which I could hold those questions and I could put them on the altar. And there's a scene in the book in which metaphorically I place these stones on the altar and saying, look, I don't know what to do with these. They bother me at a profound level, but I believe that they belong to God, and I believe they belong within the purview of faith and the sacred space of the church. And in that sense, I have relinquished. I don't feel as tortured, I think, as I did as a young adult, and that's partly the maturation process and becoming older and having more important things to think about, like children waking up at 2 a.m. That's part of it. But I would say in coming back to the church that I experienced a sense of peace knowing that those questions didn't have answers necessarily, but that there was wisdom to be had within the Christian tradition and that I wanted to experience that. There's a lot more to it than that, but that's kind of the tip of the iceberg. But great question. Yeah. Go ahead, in the back there. a mic? I can barely hear you. I'm so sorry.
I'm thinking of the scripture, faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God, and man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And having been through cancer twice, I know that I had to come to the point of realizing that my soul lived by the very word of God, not just by sight, not by things I was experiencing or feeling at the time. I'm just wondering if there were scriptures that God used to awaken faith in your heart.
You know, that's a great question. The honest answer is no, and for the following reason. You know, at the time that I came back to the church, I had shelved my Bible. I can still picture it. I lived in this apartment on the South Hill, and I had these bookshelves built out of brick and planks. I had this NIV Bible that I'd been given as a kid, I don't know, when I was 14. And it had been well used for many years, such that I had bound the back. I had to tape it up with duct tape. But it sat on the shelf for years. I didn't crack it open in particular during that time of departure from the church or absence from the church. And in that sense, there wasn't a direct piece of scripture that inspired me. But I would say I had been, you know, I'd been steeped in scripture growing up. And in that sense, I think, I was compelled, maybe indirectly. I felt, and I talk about this, but I felt the Imago Dei. I felt the image of God, the imprint upon me, through my longing, even through my doubt. And in that sense, I think there was an indirect catalyst that compelled me back into the church. So, yeah, that's my answer. Well, one more question here.
Here you go.
Yeah, Dennis. Softball.
I'm going to try to formulate my question as we go, with the possibility of sounding like a bologna sandwich, in a sense that I would have loved to run into you downtown when you were having some of your struggles. So, I guess my question is, and it's based on one of my sermons that Kathy did back at Knox a couple months ago, in the sense that there's a growth in the sense of a tortured heart, in a sense. Hmm. You know, and you have, to me, when I read your book, I was incredibly interested in just when you were going through that tortured heart experience, where you're really looking for that. So I guess my question is, from an American standpoint, we always want to pull ourselves up, you know, be happy, do this, mm-hmm. in a sense. Or I, over the last couple of years, I've just gotten a sense of feeling like a tortured heart is not necessarily a bad thing. And I still feel that you're still kind of going through that. And what you said earlier is that, you know, you've been distracted only because you've got kids now. So because of that, it's in the sense that you might be still going through that, but you've got distractions. So I would actually like you to comment on, from my standpoint, when I read the book, it's like you were going through the struggles. There was some deep pain in there, but like I said, that doesn't necessarily is not a bad thing.
No, not at all. And I think that's part of what brought me back to faith, in the sense that I realized I wasn't going to have that road to Damascus experience. Some people do, and those are very significant experiences, and I didn't. I came crawling back to the church. I was limping. So it's a great question, Dennis, and I would say, you know, I think these struggles are ongoing right now. I have other distractions, but I do feel that I will always struggle with this, you know, with some of these issues. It's partly my disposition. I'm an English major again, right? We're tortured. but, so it's partly my disposition. Not everybody feels that sense of spiritual tumult that I did and that I perhaps will feel at other times in my life. The difference now is that I'm married, I have a family. I'm married to someone, again, who is a partner for me in that pilgrimage philosophically, who can journey with me through some of these questions. But I do believe, Dennis, what you said, that these are really profound struggles that we have, and I believe that they're a part of the human experience. We all experience them in very, very unique ways at different parts of our life. Coming of age in your college years is kind of a common time for that to happen, but it happens at other times in life, and I have no doubt that I'll struggle with these things again. But I believe that God honors our honesty, and then I can submit those struggles and hold them openly in community and transparency with other people. So, again, it's a great question. That's my short answer to what ought to be a very long answer or a long discussion. So, well, thank you so much for coming. It means a lot to me to have you here. So.